Hi, this is Lucky McKee, director of The Woman, and you're listening to The Conduit Cast.
Due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
Well, first off, obviously, thank you for joining us. Can I call you Lucky?
yes, you can.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. I know that this is a talk that I've been chasing down for quite some time, but fortunately for you, you're a very, very busy man right now, huh?
Yeah.
So
maybe it'll translate into a payday.
Maybe down the road, huh?
Yeah, I just can't wait to sell out.
maybe we'll go there soon. Maybe we'll do a conference call with Michael Bay.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's in my blood.
So yeah, let's talk about this whirlwind and why I had to stalk you so long before I finally nailed you down. Let's talk about where you've been, and then I want to go back in our time machine and kind of catch our listeners up to how you got here. But obviously you've been all over the world promoting and screening and entertaining audiences with your latest project, The Woman.
Yeah, I think I did a count in my head a little while ago, and I think this last festival I went to in Sweden was the 13th one that I've been to since January.
Wow.
And the movie's played at probably three times as many festivals.
Yeah, how do you get to them all? you can't be at every one, can you?
Yeah, no. how I decided this time was kind of just like, okay, I've never been to Sweden, I've never been to Australia, I've never been to Calgary. You know, I've tried to go more to places I haven't been before. Mm-hmm. Like France, I've had to cancel trips to France like a zillion times, and I finally got to go this time, and it was great. I got to meet George Romero and talk film with him and stuff, so it's a pretty special time.
Excellent.
But yeah, it's been great. We started at Sundance in January, and we've just been showing the movie ever since.
And this is all leading up to a limited theatrical release. Well, actually, we're almost in October right now, on October 14th, right?
Yeah, in a couple of weeks.
And this is a little different for you as well.
Yeah, I haven't had a theatrical release since my first movie, May. And this is going to be a much bigger theatrical release, and there's actually some promotion behind it. It's not just getting dumped in the theaters out of a contractual obligation, you know?
Right, yeah.
The company's actually really behind it. These guys at Bloody Disgusting and the Collective, they get the movie, you know? Like, they made a good trailer that doesn't just show the horror elements, that kind of gives you an impression of the overall story and the characters that are in it. I'm just really pleased, you know? This doesn't happen very often.
So. Sure. I guess I'm going to go back chronologically. There's definitely some points I want to hit on that you can maybe thoughts that I'm having that you can tell me yay or nay. But you mentioned May briefly, and outside of everything that you've done, that's kind of the film that the audiences, the fans kind of attach themselves to. That became your calling card, and it's a very personal film for audience members and the fans. That's one that gets put on a lot of, you know, top 10 lists and movies to watch at Halloween and disturbing films and all that kind of stuff. So rather than spend a lot of time on your co-direction of All Cheerleaders Die,
right,
from 2001.
Right.
May's an important film, I think, because this is a pairing with Angela Bettis, of course. And if you could maybe just touch briefly on, is this essentially where that relationship began, where that friendship and professional bond started? Did you know Angela before this, or?
No, I didn't. I mean, we auditioned like every, you know, 20-something actress under the sun in L.A., and Angela just came in, and she was just special, you know? Like, we were instant friends, and she understood the material better than anybody, and yeah, I mean, it's been heaven ever since. I mean, she's so damn gifted at what she does. Mm-hmm, that mm-hmm, it's just, mm-hmm. it's just an incredible honor to be able to work with her over and over again, because she always surprises me, you know. She just blows my mind every time, you know.
She's one of those actors, artists, if you will, that kind of tick the boxes and always, in my mind, end up being like a criminally underused person.
I don't understand why she's not getting nominated for Oscars every year. I mean, she should be doing that caliber of stuff. I mean, she's one of the best of her generation.
Yeah, I mean, my wife's not a big genre film fan, but she and I both really love to sit down and veg out to Dexter once a week. And yeah, when she popped up on there, it was just like, you know, the first thing my wife said is, you know, that girl is creepy.
Yeah.
And I said, that's Angela Bettis, you know,
yeah.
And it's strange to see her popping up here and there. You don't want to see someone get quote unquote overused, but she really is criminally underused.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And, you know, May, for all its praise, in the horror community, it really, in my opinion, falls firmly in that dark drama, area as well, because of the emotional kind of, gravity of the character that Angela plays there. May certainly has a lot of layers to her. It's not your, you know, just straight up blood and guts for the sake of the gore. It does go there, but with reason. How collaborative was that process? You wrote it, you directed it. Angela is May. It had to been almost a symbiotic relationship while you guys were doing that.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, like, I don't do a lot of rehearsing with actors. We just have a lot of really deep one-on-one talks, like where this stuff comes from and her trying to get inside my head, and which gets easier and easier over time because she just knows how my brain works at this point. But yeah, in terms of May, I mean, you know, it's something to write it, but then it's also another thing to bring it to life, you know. And she just had the ability to make it like so much, so three dimensional, and I mean, you really care for that character a lot, even though she does some really bad things, you know. It's
sure.
I think the movie is definitely influenced by Taxi Driver, like a character like Travis Bickle, who's just this very sympathetic character that you just wish they wouldn't. They wouldn't do what they do. I mean, every time I watch Taxi Driver, I want it to work out for Travis, but it never does.
Yeah, these characters that you simultaneously want to hug and run away screaming from.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, God, sweetheart, don't.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it, though, is May embodied so many character traits that we all have, and it was just that line that that many of us butt up against on a daily basis, and what causes us to cross it or not.
Yeah, I mean, everybody feels lonely. Some, you know, some of us more than others, and everybody feels, you know, different from the rest of the world.
Sure.
So maybe that's what people are identifying with. I mean, loneliness is a pretty universal theme, I think.
It is, and it's a pretty destructive emotion, depending on how you deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think making that movie kind of healed a lot of the issue, you know, personal issues that I had, you know, that were some, not as extreme, but just, you know, just being heartbroken all the time. It's just, it's hard to live like that. And I'm really thankful for, you know, you get a lot out when you make these things, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, it was a good experience. I'm indebted to Angela for life for some of the, you know, things she helped me show in that film.
Well, what's kind of neat, and if you want to maybe touch on it while I bring this up, you know, almost 4 years later, there comes Roman, and that's written by you, directed by Angela, and you take on the titular character of Roman this time. And, you know, people are going to look at it and say that it's, you know, kind of the mirror image, the male psyche of May. But what happens between 2002, ultimately, when May is released, and then 2006, when Roman comes out? What are you all doing in that meantime?
Just trying to get things going, you know, trying to, you know, figure out my place in the movie world, you know. You know, I made a studio film for United Artists called The Woods. So that was a big learning experience to go from such a low budget film to such a big budget film. I felt like I skipped a lot of grades in school, maybe too early, but tremendous learning experience about the business and what sort of situations get the best results from me. And I think, you know, we decided to make Roman just in our apartment building at the time, partially to get my feet back on the ground and remind myself why I like to make movies, you know? So it was just, it was a really intimate experience. I think maybe like, you know, six, like eight people worked on the movie in total. So we all had to do a little bit of everything, and it was, you know, it reminded me why I got started in all of this, you know, which is just personal expression through cinema, you know? Yeah, I mean, it was a good experience. It was a good goodbye to LA and a good goodbye for me to that whole first kind of wave of experience I had there.
Right. Was there ever a moment of trepidation? Did Angela have a crazed look in her eye when she found out she was going to be able to direct you this time? Was she ready to lower the hammer on you?
It just seemed totally natural, you know, once we made the decision to kind of switch up, you know, and it's like, where she was unsure of herself as a director, I held her hand, and obviously I'm not an experienced actor, so she really held my hand a lot on the acting side, and it was just a beautiful collaboration, you know. And one of my oldest childhood friends shot the film. It's really good with a video camera, and it was just a good, simple, intimate experience. So you go
through May and Roman and. And we'll get to the woods in a second here, even though that comes before and you're getting back to your roots and your comfort zone with Roman. Would you say May and Roman are two films that even now, I mean, God, May's coming up on the 10 year anniversary here, which must seem really weird.
I'm shocked that people still talk about it, actually. That's amazing.
It's every year too. It's especially when Halloween time comes, you'll see it popping up because, you know, everyone has to make their proverbial best of or, you know, all time list. So.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how much love there is for it. It's actually, you know, through no help of the distributor, I think, you know, I mean, and the movie just kind of found its audience and has just been slowly building it over the years.
Sure.
Just kind of neat. It's been organic in that way.
Right.
But you know, I mean, I think, why, you know, Roman and May are the only personal stories that I've written that I've sacrificed to the business. And I think that might be why people identify with them so much, because they are just pure personal expression, you know?
Sure.
Those are kind of brother and sister stories. So there's a link between them. So
when Mick Garris comes calling and tells you that you're coming to the luncheon and you're a master of horror now, what does that feel like? I mean, seriously.
I remember being told I was a master of horror. No, it was amazing to be invited. You know, it was really surreal, especially the first dinner I went to where I'm sitting there with, you know, eating dinner next to just all these guys. I mean, these idols of mine, you know, these guys, I grew up watching their films and I study all of their films and, I steal from them all liberally. It was just an incredible honor, you know, incredible honor. It's a dream, you know, to be able to pick those guys' brains. I've learned so much from them and made a couple of them become really close friends.
Now, did you have pretty, much free reign during Masters of Horror in terms of what you wanted to adapt? Were there specific things to choose from? How did that all work out?
I came in late because Roger Corman couldn't do an episode. I guess he got sick. I guess a couple of the old veterans recommended me, which was very nice. And, they gave me a few scripts to choose from and I chose Sick Girl. And then Mick just basically said, you know, do whatever you want with the script, you know, turn it into your own thing. So I took a story that was sorry, my screen just went black. I took a story that was basically, you know, just a love story between a guy and a girl, and I changed it to a girl and a girl, and all sorts of cool stuff started coming up, you know, because I wanted Angela to be the main character, so I just turned the character into a woman.
Sure.
And then all this cool thematic stuff started coming up, like the conflict with the landlady. And,
Which sometimes is absolutely hilarious. It's really, I mean, it's not necessarily dark humor because sometimes it is played for comedy, but I mean, that relationship is really sometimes kind of funny.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's so funny because I'm the youngest guy to work on that show on that first season, and I think I made the most old-fashioned sort of story, you know? I mean, yeah, it's like a lesbian bug movie, but it's very much influenced by the romantic comedies of the 30s and 40s, and, you know, I mean, it's all the technique is just really, really old stuff, you know? I mean, I don't think I used any camera techniques that were, you know, anywhere past like the 50s or 60s, you know?
Sure, yeah. And the age-old, you know, of course, lesbian bug story goes back in time. Did you see yourself kind of getting ready to make a creature feature, or was that all secondary?
What's that?
What, did you kind of see yourself as making a creature feature, or was that kind of secondary to the story for Masters of Horror?
It's secondary to the characters.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Like
mm-hmm.
that, all those elements are just, you know, like metaphors or whatever you want to call it for what it's like to get into a relationship too quickly, you know, and then suddenly realizing that, you know, the person that you're hooked up with may have issues you weren't aware of when you first got with them.
Sure.
So yeah. But you know, it's more of a romantic comedy than anything else. You know, I think that's why it kind of baffled some people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes some of the reveals that much more off-putting. So that's for sure.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to mix all the genres up, you know, and like make people feel like they're going in one direction with one sort of mood or emotion, and then to throw a monkey wrench into that. I think that's really fun. So,
well, what was that like for you working with the practical effects, like seeing them evolve, and then ultimately, you know, Angela as Bug Lady. That's kind of new. That was new territory for you. You've obviously use makeup effects and things like that in your films, and but to have something that kind of big and elaborate on set in camera right there, did that pose any issues, or did you just kind of go with it and yeah, that's that, and let's move back to the characters in the story?
No, it's interesting, you know, because I was shooting at a pretty fast pace. I mean, there was some days where I shot like, you know, 8 to 10 pages, and then, you know, we get to all the effects stuff and we spend, you know, it's our only day. We went like an hour overtime, just trying to get 45 seconds, you know, of all that special effects stuff, because it's really involved and it's really tedious, you know, and if I didn't have someone like K&B, it would have, you know, it would have taken probably 10 times as long, because those guys have such great experience, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, the goal was not to make something that looked realistic, like in a Cronenberg movie or something like that, but just to make something that looked cool and kind of had its own look. And I didn't want to do any computer graphics at all. So I asked them to take whatever budget they had for the computer graphics and just give it to K&B so we could do all the stuff for real. I don't know if they actually did that. They probably
Yeah, so, sure, we will.
Probably just pocketed the money and, you know,
right.
It or whatever. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of my intention at the time. Now I'm not so closed off to try, you know, using any technique I can get my hands on. But
sure,
at the time I just wanted to do something that was just organic and photographed. I had this attitude that I wanted to make movies, not cartoons,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of silly because, I mean, you know, they're all tools, and you know, if they're used correctly and in combination, they can be effective. So
effectively being the operative word there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you touched briefly on the woods, and with your Masters of Horror episode debuting in 2006 on Showtime, had you been working on the woods? Were you done with the woods? How did that all fit in?
The woods was all done before I did Masters of Horror. It was probably done like 8 months before.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not that, maybe 6 months. But yeah, The Woods was a really long, grueling process working with the studio, but I'm glad I did it. I learned a lot, and I never abandoned the film, which I think the studios kind of try to put, you know, they back you into a corner and they just try to beat up on you as much as possible until you, you know, they hope you'll go away, but mm-hmm. I never did, you know, so the movie is, you know, it will always be my, you know, more my movie than it is their movie. There's some artistic flourishes that I got shot down on by the studio, and they really hampered me in terms of the budget for the ending. That's why the ending is a little truncated. That's probably about a third of what it should be in terms of scale and length. But, you know, that was all learning process. You know, I think I would obviously handle the whole situation completely different now, but, you know, you got to learn sometime, you know,
and I'm, sure. I'm glad
I learned it on somebody else's book and actually got paid to make a movie for the first time, which is pretty awesome.
Well, and I mean, you're a director for hire on this. And, I mean, how does a conscious choice,
you know,
what's that?
That was a conscious choice. I had a personal film that I wanted to make as a follow-up to May, but after having my first experience, spending somebody else's money on a personal project, I got really protective of my personal work and decided to wait until, I had built the proper insulation around myself as a filmmaker. And in the meantime, just, I tried to do a director for hire thing, but, I can't really say if that was a good or bad decision, but it definitely sent me off in a different direction than I'd always seen myself going. I don't think I would be as proud of the woman if I hadn't learned all the things I learned on, you know, my successes and failures before it, you know. So.
Well, I don't know if you've always been at this place to be able to look back on things and take the good out of them, but a lot of people in general, but artists and filmmakers, can allow that that to fester inside them and not be a positive thing. So,
yeah, man, it sucks when you end up, you know, you dream so much, you know, your whole life, you know, in my case, most of your life, you dream of doing this, you know, working in the movie world and, putting your own personal stamp on things, doing that, and then you end up working with people that almost, you know, feels like they're just trying to make you hate what you love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really damaging my creativity being in that sort of environment. So, you know, after The Woods was done, we made Roman, just this really simple little film, and then I just got the hell out. You know, I moved to the middle of nowhere,
mm-hmm. right,
like that, and just started trying to, you know, study a lot and try to get back to that place where I felt creatively safe again.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for you, you weren't super recognizable. I mean, there were rumors of sightings of you in back alleys and living in boxes down in Chinatown after The Woods. I didn't totally buy into those sightings, but I guess fortunately for you, you weren't ascending the ranks as you are now, so you can deny that you ever were living in a van down by the river. So, let's get into your, maybe the beginnings of your relationship with Jack Ketchum, because you had something to do with, one of his adaptations, Red.
Yeah.
Which go ahead.
First off, I helped produce the first Jack Ketchum novel to be made into a film, a movie called The Lost.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the rights to the book from my buddy Chris, and then he somehow got the budget together and made the film. And that's kind of where my relationship with Ketchum started, through my friend Chris, who was a big fan of his books and introduced me to them. And Chris is a very, very awesome director in his own right. I've been attached to make Red for quite some time and eventually got the chance to make it. And it just went bad, man. Like they ran out of money halfway through the production and shut everything down, and we disagreed on the proper way to continue the movie, so they fired me,
mm-hmm.
Which was horrible. I mean, I was about an inch away from, you know, deciding to not ever make a movie again, because I just couldn't go through that kind of heartache again. I mean, it's like having a, you know, the cinematic equivalent of having a miscarriage, you know.
Christ, yeah. This is a real feel-good story here, Lucky.
Yeah, I'm doing the best I can to keep everybody cheery. But hey, you know, it's the business that we work in, you know.
Sure.
Again, you know, I, the things I learned from having such a great, you know, it was going so well, and the movie was looking really good. I think it could have been a really, really great film. It would have changed a lot of things for me, but it just wasn't the time, I guess, you know, and mm-hmm. as a result of losing it, it made me a lot harder when I went into making The Woman. You know, I had a very, very specific set of rules and lines drawn around me that I refused to have crossed. I think I ended up making the purest film that I've made as a result.
Well, and what, as far as it goes with Ketchum, I'm also a big fan of his books.
Yeah.
Red was one that, you know, as a pet owner and someone who welcomes our pets into our home as family, tugged at the heartstrings, of course. It was hard to, there were a lot of elements in that film, and I think Brian Cox made a great Avery, emotionally, I got on board with him, but one of my favorite books and adaptations of Ketchum's is The Girl Next Door.
Yeah,
fucking brutal book. True horror story. The evil that man does.
Sure.
Fantastically engaging and difficult to watch film. And once I read The Girl Next Door, I was kind of all in with Ketchum. Kind of.
Yeah.
No matter what he did, I was there. And
it's really powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And you know, that when the woman came along, I knew that there was a book coming, and I still haven't read the book, actually. I do have the book now, but I haven't read it. But when the woman came along, there was essentially the germ of a story, and it basically read, Lucky McKee, director of May. Here we go, pushing you all the way back to 2002.
Yeah.
Teams up with iconic horror author Jack Ketchum to bring you, excuse me, to bring you this film, The Woman. Now, The Woman, in a loose way, is the sequel to, and I'll flat out say it for me personally, a god awful film from 2009 called Offspring. Again, a story that Ketchum wrote, which was a fantastic book. And I'll never forgive him for adapting it into this film and attaching the screenwriter tag to himself.
Yeah.
For me, the only element that was interesting and dangerous and engrossing in this whole film was Pollyanna as
the woman. She's what sold me on doing the sequel.
I would hope it wasn't anything else. But to me though, there's no need to connect these two in my own mind, because I think ultimately for me, sometimes the character's backstory isn't as essential to where the character is and where they're going.
I tried to make it as its own standalone film, you know, that weren't required to know anything about the previous novels or the previous movie, in order to enjoy this, you know, on its own. My producer Andrew, who directed Offspring, and I have actually talked about this a lot, and it's actually more interesting for people to watch The Woman first, and then if you're curious about the woman character and seeing some other adventures, then I think it's cool to go back and see Offspring.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's better to watch them in the opposite order. But because maybe it'll make you look at Offspring with different eyes.
Yeah, maybe I should revisit it. I don't know.
I'm not going to twist your arm.
You'd have to pull the fucker off, trust me.
It was a very well-received film, I know that. And you know, having it announced that I was making a sequel to it really kept everybody's expectations really low, which was a big advantage to me.
Mm. Well, when we were headed down to Philly to check out The Woman, I live about 2 hours north of Philadelphia now, and I drove down and met a couple friends, and a couple of them, you know, through conversations before, they were asking me, should I see Offspring first? And I'm glad I told them no, not for the reason you did, because I didn't know what I was getting into either, but I just told them no, it's a shit film. So we all kind of, I was the only one who went in kind of knowing that the woman character was carried over.
Yeah.
But I have to say that, for me, it really, that prior knowledge evaporated the minute the lights went down. because, and here's what I'm getting into, and we're not going to beat this to death, but we're going to, I'm going to take you into the land of hypothetical thought. Sundance. And let's say that the woman plays at Sundance. Okay. And the lights come up and everyone applauds and you do your Q&A and everyone goes on their merry way and there's no awards, there's no hoopla, there's no major buzz about it. It's just, you know, Lucky McKee, Jack Ketchum, you know, genre horror film. The woman premieres at Sundance to, I don't know, let's just go out on a limb and say standing ovation. Okay?
Okay.
there is no viral video that goes on YouTube and shows a gentleman leaving after, you know, causing a stink and talking about how you should be dragged out back and shot. This type of film has no place in our society. It's misogynistic. And I've seen you and Pollyanna talking about this. That was, I mean, you could have thrown out your whole marketing budget right there.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's amazing. It's amazing how much notoriety that one guy freaking out gave the film, you know?
So what do you think if we're in our hypothetical, mindset, where do you think you are today without that guy?
I don't
and
know.
And is he now part of your team?
I wish he was. I wish I'd have been smart enough to think to pay somebody to do that, which a lot of people have been kind of, you know, insinuating that I did, which is not the case. I mean, if that guy just, his brain just broke, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I, you know, that's all theoretical. So I can't really say where I would be. I mean, hopefully, you know, the film was designed for people that like my stuff and like Jack Ketchum's stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think the film would have done okay without that. But that, you know, that was a tremendous boost, you know, controversy never hurts a thing. And,
no,
you know,
no.
it's, you know, I'm a huge fan of films like Peeping Tom and Straw Dogs and Clockwork Orange and the notorious films, you know, and, I'd always wanted to make one like that, so I kind of just went for it on this. And I'd had so many bad experiences in the business up to that point that maybe there's a little bit of anger and meanness kind of inside me, when I made the film. So it's pretty unapologetic in its brutality. But, you know, I handled it with as much tact as I possibly could. I didn't want to just be shoving the sex and violence and cruelty in your face and like in an overly overt way. I mean, the movie definitely has its moments, but, you know, I don't think it completely bludgeons you. It just kind of sucks you in and traps you for a little while.
Sure. Sure. And I know you've read my review of the film and I know you've read 600 other reviews, so you probably don't remember a damn word I said, but, when the woman kind of garnered that attention because of that reaction, and you mentioned a lot of films that are really, highly revered. And one of them, you know, I've given up on making a stink about remakes of classics, but I have to say when, the Straw Dogs, remake was announced and then finally made its way into theaters, that one actually really hurt me, because I love, Straw Dogs so much.
Yeah.
That was one that I couldn't necessarily not be livid over. And you're right. I mean, you have even from the days, you know, when women were supposedly aborting their fetuses while watching The Exorcist. you know, you have stories like that all the time. And I think the general consensus that came out of that Sundance screening was that the woman was, and once again, just like, I don't know, let's say the Serbian film that came before it, or any other of a handful of films, the woman was the most, disturbing and graphically misogynistic film, ever planted into a theater, just like the second Human Centipede film is coming out now, and it's the most disgusting and shocking, sexually perverted film to, you know, hit the streets in recent memory. So, I have to say that, you know, I'm in general a huge film lover. I've finally seen my film of the year when I went and saw Drive when it came out.
It's my film of the year too, man. That's fucking
sick. You know, and I was following Refn, and you know, I love his films, and I was so mad when I saw that he was directing this, but I stuck with it, and when it was released, I went solely based on him. And it shook my soul, that film.
Too, man, it stays with you. It's tremendous.
It's so I mean, we could sit and talk about that for sure, as long as you wanted to, but there are moments of pretty extreme violence peppered throughout that film as well.
And they're only effective because of all the quiet, you know, early on. You know,
that's where I was getting. Yeah, that's what I was going to, because when I left that film, I actually overheard two guys waiting for a third to come out of the restroom talking about how fucking boring the first hour of that movie was.
I heard similar conversations after I saw it, and people were like, get to the fucking point. It's like, you don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
It's made like every second this film is, you know, going by.
Yeah.
It's just impatience, you know.
Well, it's just, you know, stay at home and watch the 17th Fast and Furious movie on Blu-ray if you really want that. I mean, there are moments in that film where, you know, they're in the elevator, for example, and I'm not going to really give anything away, but he gently pushes her into the corner of the elevator into that incredible light.
Yeah.
And he stays in the darkness.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kisses her, and to me, he's kissing her hello and goodbye at the same time, because he knows at that moment that everything is about to change.
Yeah.
And he'll never be able to go back.
Yeah.
And I guess I can't expect other people to feel that or see that when they're watching a film like that, but that was, to me, one of the most poignant moments in cinema that I had ever witnessed. And, you know, there are moments for like that for me in Raging Bull and other films like that, but when he, you know, when he puts her in the light and is basically saying, you know, this is where you belong and this is where I belong, here in the darkness. I don't know. Okay.
It's nuts. It's moving stuff, you know, and just the contrast of tones and emotion in the film are just, you know, it's just lovely.
The score, the musical cues, the songs that were chosen for that film.
The unspoken.
Absolutely. The silence, you know.
Yeah, silence is just gorgeous.
Yeah, and that look, I haven't gone back and seen it again. I want to see it one more time in theaters, but when the elevator doors open and she exits and he's looking at her just dripping in sweat and breathing out of his nose, not even opening his mouth, like he's panting, but through his nose.
Yeah.
And, yeah, wow. Great stuff.
I agree.
So I mentioned that, for a brief second, because if you don't go into a film like Drive, and you don't have to expect it, but once you see it, if you don't allow yourself to be pulled into the emotion of the story and the journey that you're going to be taken on, if you just want to, you know, the car chases and the blood and guts and, you know, whatever, you're going to be those two guys standing outside the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
With the woman, there's a similar thread that runs through, where a lot of people who are going to see this are expecting, you know, this hyperactive, you know, blood and guts, man's destruction of women, in your face type of film.
Yeah.
But with the family that is built and put around these other characters, the character of the woman and of Chris Cleek, who, by the way, Sean Bridgers, you know, bravo.
Yeah, he's amazing in the thing. Yeah, I'm really proud of him.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we'll get to him in a minute. But the family that's assembled around these two characters that are at odds with one another, is really, to me, the heart and soul of the film. And here again, you have Angela Bettis, who comes in as, you know, Belle Clique. And I don't want to give too much away, but she does have kind of her moment, a monologue in the film, kind of right before things go even farther to hell. And that, to me, was just an amazing moment in the film. I don't know if that exactly is in the book, because as I told you, I haven't read the book yet, but her dialogue and the way it's delivered there is really, for me, kind of became the tipping point for the whole story.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Absolutely.
So we backtrack here. Let's just go through a little bit of the film. You know, Chris Cleek is husband and father, and he runs the ship, so to speak.
Yeah.
He's got two daughters and a son and a wife, and he does essentially what he wants to do. It's, you know, not too far off from the way I grew up. That type of mentality was part of my home. My father was the guy who made the money. He was the guy who made the decisions. And there were a lot of times that my mom didn't necessarily agree with what was going on, but she knew it would be better to keep her mouth closed than to open it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's plenty of people that have lives like that and are living them as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that makes me angry about not the woman, but the reaction to it, is that it was treated, in my opinion, like these people not only don't exist, but this type of behavior doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And these people that believe this either fall into one or two camps. They don't want to believe it, and they know it's out there, but they just don't want to believe it and admit it, or they really have their head firmly planted up their asses and don't know that it's out there. So on a different level there, I was identifying strongly with these kids and the mom, which was kind of odd. So, excuse me, Chris goes off in the nearby woods on a little hunting expedition, and he sees the woman magnificently embodied by Pollyanna McIntosh, or is it McIntosh or McIntosh?
McIntosh.
Okay. And she's cleaning her wounds from the first film, but we don't really need to worry about that.
Yeah.
She's kind of bathing in a stream, and there's this interesting, never mind, I'm not going to go there. so he hatches a plan, and boy, oh boy, does he hatch a plan. He is going to bring this feral woman home. He's going to enlist the help of his family, some more willing than others, to break and socialize and humanize this beast of a being.
Yeah.
And from that,
or so he says.
Or so he says, sure. And from that point on, there's all kinds of different heads that begin to butt, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's lovely, because you have each of these family members filling what could have been a very stereotypical or expected role. Oh, sure, this person's going to do this, and this person's going to do that. But the chaos that's swirling around this whole situation kind of allows them not to be kind of pigeonholed or stereotyped for too long. So let's talk a little bit about how brutal this film is, because my background, the number of films that I watch, what I've seen, I know you saw in my review, this is not the most brutal film I've ever seen. And that's not a good or a bad thing. That's just, you know, when you have someone flipping out, and then the word starts spreading about what to expect with this film, the reality of the situation is that what's going on both in these characters' eyes and behind their eyes is much more terrifying than any of the bloodshed that you see.
Oh, good. I'm glad you see it that way.
It is, it's to me frightening to see, father and son interact and what becomes of that. It's heartbreaking, for me to watch the two female children, especially little darling.
Yeah.
I have a 7-year-old son.
Yeah.
And when I saw her being forced to swim in and out of this chaos and to view it in kind of the periphery, I couldn't help but place my son into that situation.
Yeah.
And although she's, you know, a bit younger, there's still that element of exposing the innocence of child to, to this and thinking that it's just a natural, part of, you know, this family dynamic. And
Helen's character is really important because, you know, of all the family members, she's the only one who hasn't been socialized yet. She hasn't gone to school yet.
Mm-hmm.
Her world at home is completely normal to her. That's why her reactions are so, you know,
blasé.
Yeah, she's just, you know,
mm-hmm.
just none of it's a big deal to her. You
right.
know? Which, you know, gets us to that really, really unique sort of ending that we have with the film.
Yeah, unique, to say the least.
You have a kind of a cross section too. You know, you have Brian, who's 12 years old, who's in that, you know, puberty sort of stage where all your chemicals are at war with you, you know? And to me, one of the most rotten ages a child can be is 12 or 13 years old.
Amen.
Cause they're, you know, they're so confused and angry and they don't know why and, you know, everything's changing and, you know, so that his character was really interesting in that way. And then you have the angst-ridden teen with the secret and the daughter Peg, you know?
Yeah.
So there's kind of a good cross section. There's someone, you know, out of all those family members, there's at least one person that you can identify with, you know, depending on who you are as a person. You know?
Absolutely. And I think what's important as well is when you can recognize and maybe even identify with some of the nastiest things going inside of the antagonist, which can be very scary to an audience member.
Sure. That was the whole point, you know, is this movie, the intent was to make monsters, you know, that look like you and me, you know,
mm-hmm.
somebody you'd go to a barbecue with or somebody you'd run across in the supermarket or that your kids, you know, kid that your kids go to school with. And the way, you know, everybody has their, you know, their fucked up family stuff, you know, to varying degrees. And everybody thinks their family is, you know, are weird or strange and have all these problems. And we look at other people and on the surface and we think, why can't my family be like that? And which is a fallacy. I mean, like everybody has issues going on behind closed doors at home, you know, whether they want to admit it to themselves or not, you know?
Sure. And
so I think, you know, that might be what's upsetting people, but I've had, you know, a lot of people come up to me that have been abused in their life and have been in these sort of situations and they've thanked me for kind of showing it what it truly is. You know, we just tried mm-hmm. to be as frank as possible, you know, about our approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the film, looks fantastic, first of all. But it's such a complete, genre mindfuck to me because much like Drive, where the music and the score and the sound and the silence are so perfectly placed into it, much of the sound and silence, music and score are so ill-placed in your film that it has the same dramatic effect on me. And I think others too, as more people see this, but there are things that you show us that we know we're supposed to feel a certain way about because that's the way society tells us to feel about it.
Yeah.
But what we're hearing is making us fight that thought process or emotion, albeit when the woman is bathing in the stream.
Yeah.
You have a lot of stuff on the internet and, you know, you see it in different communities and whatnot, you know, sexy women posing with knives covered in blood and, you know, that's hot and whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, the fantastic sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so you have this filthy, feral woman bathing in a stream, beautiful woman, despite what might be caked on her.
Yeah.
And you have Chris looking at her, and then you have this, and I'm not going to give it away, but you have this just incredible song pounding over the top of it.
Yeah, and I'm so tired of most movie scores in general that just follow a story along, you know. And I wanted to use music that made you look at the pictures in a different way, and threw you off like what you're saying, and also kind of represented, you know, emotionally what might be going through some of these characters' heads. You know, I mean, I think that the use of that song when he sees the woman for the first time is very representative of the way Chris Kleek's brain works, you know, and it's disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing really missing from that is a pole and fluorescent lights.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where it starts, where some people were saying, look at this filmmaker. You have this poor, wounded, feral woman. She's bathing, and look at the music he's playing. He already wants her to be sexualized and demeaned, and that's the kind of stuff that just blew my mind when all this was coming out. But you know, that's neither here nor there. People are going to feel the way they're going to.
Some music is wildly inappropriate, but I don't think so.
I think it was wildly disturbing.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a bunch of secrets in this film and twists and turns the most shocking thing to me wasn't even what was done to the woman or what the woman does in return.
Yeah.
It was the other little secret that the family harbors. Yeah.
Kinda, when you sit back and think about it, though, it kind of starts to make everything else make a lot more sense, though.
It makes total sense in the most disturbing and haunting way. This was the natural progression.
Yeah, the woman isn't Dad's first project. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yep, that 57 in the Chevy in the backup on blocks was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So Angela was a natural choice to be in this film, yes?
Yeah, it was written. That part was written for her.
Yeah, how proud of her are you?
It's fucking incredible, man. Like, just, you know, like when we got back to my place out in the middle of nowhere and started cutting, and I started going through the footage and just watching what she was doing, it's like, I just, every time I work with her, she just blows me away. It's like it's a new experience every time, but, you know, she's just magic. When you point a camera at her, you know, she's born to do it. I doubt it'll be the last time I work with Angela.
I hope not, because you seem to be one of the people that really, really gives her something substantial to chew on, and she destroys it every time. She absolutely kills it. And for people listening, once you sit with Belle Kleek for that 3-minute monologue, and you'll know once it starts exactly what I'm talking about, but that 3 minutes is some of the finest 3 minutes you'll ever see on film.
Oh, thank you.
When she...
I'm really proud of that sequence. It is very, very intense, and it makes me sick every time I watch it, you know, the way it turns out. I mean, it's one of the more brutal things I've ever filmed.
It's the last ditch effort, and knowing that nothing will come of it.
Yeah, and it just sets off the whole, you know, the whole melee at the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I could ask you the common question, what's next for Lucky, but I don't want you to answer that because I don't want to know.
Good.
I don't want my audience to know or to speculate. I will say this, that I hope you have some stuff on your plate that you want to do, because you're no doubt going to start getting some phone calls, and I'm hoping that this film allows you to do something that's yours, that you want to do with the team that you want to do it with, because the stories that you tell have been very personal to me, but have also, I think, resonated with a large portion of the genre community. So I personally am excited to be in the dark and maybe
that's rare these days.
Oh, that'll be kind of cool to see, you know, the first exclusive from whatever website or magazine and your name pop up with your new film. But I'm hoping that it's written and directed by Lucky McKee.
Yeah, that might be the case.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to say about the woman? Because I'm one of those people that doesn't like to do a whole lot. I mean, I can sit here and say this film is fucking incredible. You know, see it when you can. Check it out October 14th. It'll have a limited theatrical release. Check on the website, blah, 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 thumb up my butt, whatever. It's a good film. It's a very, very good film. It's got fantastic performances throughout it. I can't wait to read the book. I'm interested to see what was maintained visually and thematically. To me, at this point, this will be what I identify you with as much as May is personal to you. I think when you talked about all the shit that you had to shovel to get to this point, I think this is a very strong indicator of how you left out the bad and took the good from all of your experiences up to this point. Because you really did, I think, fine-tune a lot of your artistic skills on this one. It looks and sounds and feels fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much.
So it was neat to hear you talk about, you know, some of your issues with a studio type film, and it makes sense to me now to hear you say that and see how you transitioned all of that craziness and harnessed it into the woman. If you will.
Yeah, that's pretty much what happened. I mean, the woman is kind of a bookend of everything that I've done up to this point, you know, so hopefully I can go into, you know, I can go into some new realms with the next few things I make.
Awesome.
I mean, the biggest thing I would want to say is, you know, if the movie is playing in a theater, you know, anywhere relatively close to you, please go see it in the theater. You know, it's like, very rare that a small horror film like this gets the kind of notoriety that this is getting. But, you know, none of that was really going to mean anything unless people, you know, buy some tickets and go see it and support it. Or we're just going to keep getting the same, you know, dull crap over and over again from the studios, you know.
It's a great film to, let's say it plays at a theater within 2 hours of you on October 14th, okay? It's a great film on a cool October night to get in your car, drive through the dark as the leaves are blowing across the road, got, you know, the Halloween season in your mind, craving an original horror film, and to see it, you know, on the big screen, the way it was meant to, all, you know, all the sights and sounds. It's not a remake. It's not a sequel. It's not a rehash of something old. It what could be better for someone who complains on a day-to-day basis about having nothing to see in the theater that ticks their horror boxes?
Well, that's the thing. If you drive that 2 hours to see the movie, I guarantee you, you're going to have something to talk about for the 2 hours on the way back. You know?
Thank you. Yeah, definitely.
It sparks a lot of conversations because, you know, the movie doesn't hand you everything on a plate, mm-hmm. you know? It's designed to inspire discussion, you know, and I've had fantastic talks with people and, hopefully people will see it and it'll stay with them for a little while and make them think about how we all treat each other.
Well, and I'm going to tag it the date movie of 2011 right now.
Perfect.
Because I think that if you're just starting out or you're in a relationship with a significant other, and you have that 2 hours to talk afterwards, you may just having an honest conversation about the film, you may be able to find out if that person really is just right for you.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great way to look at it.
So I thank you sincerely, sir.
Thank you.
For the time, and I wish you continued success, but I hope that you survive the rest of your travels associated with it.
Me too.
Where's next?
Los Angeles for the premiere, and then the Sitges Film Festival in Spain, which is one of my very favorite festivals, so that should be pretty fun.
That's exciting. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Very,
1,200 insane Spanish people watching them.
Now, did you have anything to do with the subtitling?
No, they have a specific dialect in that region called Catalan, so it'll probably be in Spanish and Catalan.
I'm kind of curious to know how the content translates, you know?
With French subtitles in Strasbourg recently, and it was funny, you know, seeing how they were translating some of the stuff.
Get over here and give me your bicycle tire.
Yeah.
Again, congratulations. You know, with Angela and Pollyanna is a revelation. I hope that this opens up doors for her as well.
I think it will.
It has to. Well, you say it has to, but nothing would surprise me.
Yeah, exactly.
But congratulations to you, to your whole team. I'm very proud to have been able to see the film when I did, and when it comes out in theaters, once I've seen Drive again, I will. I'll see Drive. I'll put a toothpick in my mouth, and
right.
I'll drive down to Philly to check out the
basic gloves. Again. Yeah.
Yeah. So and my satin scorpion jacket.
Nice.
But this was very very fun, very natural. You're quite a nice guy, Lucky.
Oh, thanks.
And I appreciate the time, and I'll get this this up and let you know when it's ready for a listen.
Cool, please do that.
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, man, take care.
You too.